WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Have you seen Leaving Neverland yet? If not, you've probably heard about it. It's the new HBO documentary about Michael Jackson and his secret life as a sexual abuser of young children. It is a really hard watch. The four-hour documentary centers on two of Jackson's alleged sexual abuse victims, Wade Robeson and James Safechuck. Robeson and Safechuck, now both in their 30s, say that Jackson sexually abused them for years when they were as young as 7 and 10 years old. Here's Wade Robeson talking about his strained, complicated, really supremely contradictory relationship with Michael Jackson.
He was one of the kindest, most gentle, loving, caring people I knew. He helped me tremendously. He helped me with my career. He helped me with my creativity, with all of those sorts of things. And he also sexually abused me for 7 years.
The documentary is graphic and depicts acts of graphic sexual abuse. Even if you're not a victim of sexual abuse yourself, I'd say it could be hard to watch. And maybe even more so because Michael Jackson is perhaps the single most iconic performer who ever lived and provided the soundtrack to so many people's daily lives. As our next guest asks, what would canceling Michael Jackson even look like? And is that the right question to even start with? Wesley Morris is the New York Times critic at large and co-host of the Still Processing podcast. His article on the film is called Michael Jackson Cast a Spell, Leaving Neverland Breaks It. Hi, Wesley. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
I'm okay. This is a tough topic. And as a diehard Michael Jackson fan, I'm curious what your expectations or mindset were before seeing the documentary.
I don't even know that I would. Is diehard even the right word? I think I'm an American. And, you know, I grew up in this country, I mean, more or less raised on Michael Jackson, you know, among other people. And I think a lot of me and, you know, my growing up, Michael Jackson passed through that like he did a lot of other people. So it's more than just a fandom. I think that for me, I think he's, I mean, not quite a member of my family in the way that he was Wade Robeson and Wade Robeson's and James Safechuck's. But he's a part of our psyches in this way that I don't think we really quite appreciate. So watching this movie, I think, was hard in that it forced me to have to think about Michael Jackson in a way that A, I didn't want to, and B, I didn't think I was entirely prepared to. But at some point in watching this, two things happen. One thing is that you realize that Michael Jackson is not this child in the way that we like to think of him as being. You know, I mean, he is a fully sentient adult who makes choices. And you know, some of those choices were bad. they're worse than bad. And the other thing is that you then have to think about, I mean, at least what I thought about it while I was watching it, was that I had been sitting with these stories about Michael Jackson and children for almost as long as I was aware that there was a Michael Jackson. And I think now begins this process with these two men telling actual stories of their relationship with him, this process of trying to figure out what to do with this information in the context of everything else we know about Michael Jackson as an artist and as a man.
And you're right that there was this moment in the film where you had to stop looking for excuses for Michael Jackson and stop analyzing him even. And that was this moment where Safechuck describes going ring shopping with Jackson. What was it about that moment?
I think it's the simultaneous ceremonialization of this relationship between these two people, between this grown man and this child.
Where we should just say, for context, Michael Jackson took this little kid out to buy wedding rings for each other, like they were getting married, right?
Yes. And so there's this ceremonialization of that relationship, and also not only the ceremony, but the making it official, right? You know, there's this moment in the Thriller video where he takes Ola Ray out, and it's before he turns into a werewolf. And I think there's this conversation they have where he says to her, "We're gonna make this official, or let's make this official." And I don't know. I thought about that while I was listening to James Safechuck tell this story. But the other thing is that we're talking about a kid who really wouldn't have any idea about this ritual. You know, I think he would ambiently maybe understand that adults get married, but the idea that he himself would be a bridegroom in Michael Jackson's fully cognizant understanding of A, what a marriage actually is, and also that it was wrong. Because when they go to part of the story that James Safechuck tells is that they go to the store to buy the rings, and Michael Jackson says to the salesperson that it's for a woman. And there's just this sense that, you know, all of the complexities of what he's doing are completely aware. He's completely aware of them, and he's carrying around all of the desire to have this relationship with this boy, but also the sort of moral awareness that it's wrong.
Yeah. And you were too young to be a culture critic back in the early 90s, but Michael Jackson did go through trials, as you know, where he was acquitted of sexual abuse allegations. And it feels collectively as a country and as fans, we just moved on. And we should say that these same two kids, now grown-ups, denied back in the day that Michael Jackson ever sexually abused them. So how do those acquittals and those past denials inform your view of it all?
Well, I mean, I guess you kind of have to take the whole thing holistically. You know, I mean, I think that the awareness that this stuff was going on in the early 1980s, and not only was it going on, Brian, I mean, you remember this, we were all paying attention to this. I mean, that Oprah Winfrey interview that she did in 1993 the whole country watched it.
Right. And she confronted him with that.
Yes. And, you know, 10 years later, more than 10 years later, the Martin Bashir documentary that follows Michael Jackson around he has 8 months worth of access to Michael Jackson. And that was also hugely watched. So, I mean, it's really interesting to think about this moment that this movie is provoking in the context first of whatever we're calling, what we're calling the Me Too era, in which people who accuse the accusers of abusers are being believed in a way that they hadn't previously been, and that the accused are being forced to reckon with our relationship with the accused. I also think that we're doing that on the one hand, but we also have just been aware of, for all this time, the idea that Michael Jackson might have done this. And we have been looking for either a reason to exonerate him or a way to live with the reality and the possibility that he did do it.
Wesley Morris, New York Times culture critic, with us on Leaving Neverland, the HBO documentary about Michael Jackson and sexual abuse. just out. And the documentary doesn't focus that much on the psyche of Michael Jackson. It doesn't put him on the couch per se or ask what about his childhood or his life of extreme fame made him this way. But in your article, you ask some questions like that. Like, is there something about Michael Jackson that makes it more tempting to analyze him versus, say, R. Kelly or Bill Cosby, where it seems easier to say they were abusers and that's that? How do you answer that question?
Well, I mean, in terms of a difference, I think the difference, well, God, I mean, Michael Jackson is just, he's just an order of magnitude greater. I mean, many orders of magnitude greater as a cultural presence. And I think some of the reason for that is that Michael Jackson has been in many people's lives from his childhood to his death. I mean, I think that, you know, he'd been working as a professional musician since, what was he, 6 or 7? And he became famous a little bit after that. And I think he became sexualized, you know, during, you know, his childhood. And it's funny, but we don't talk about this in terms of our memory of Michael Jackson. But I mean, if you think about some of the lyrics of a song like ABC, or I Want You Back, I mean, this is a child singing about really adult concepts, mm-hmm. Adult relationship concepts and bodies and sex. And I think that we just know Michael Jackson. We feel like we know this person and we have watched him evolve. We've watched him evolve as an artist and as a human being and as a physical specimen. And I think that there's an attachment to him that is just unlike anybody else in the history of American entertainment.
So what do we do about the art in that context, right? This question keeps coming up as people's bad acts get revealed. Do people go to Woody Allen movies anymore or watch Louis C.K. stand-ups, you know? But with Michael Jackson, you ask, what would canceling him even look like?
I can't. I mean, I don't know how many people in New York City have this problem. But I mean, it didn't used to. I wouldn't have previously classified this as a problem, but I can't go a day in this city without hearing a Michael Jackson song. And it's not even because I played it. You're just out in the world and the music is just everywhere. If it's not actually a Michael Jackson song, it's a song made out of Michael Jackson songs. It's a song that is obviously inspired by Michael Jackson. I mean, the Weeknd is an artist where you hear his music or you hear his style. Bruno Mars is another person. I mean, there's any number of, it isn't so, I don't think the question with regard to Michael Jackson especially is so much whether or not to listen to the music. It's really a question of how do you listen to the music. And I don't mean like how could you bring yourself to. It is more like what do you do? How do you hear it when you hear it? Because you're going to. And I think there's a lot of resistance to this movie, and I think a lot of that resistance has something to do with, it's some combination of not wanting to believe the accusers, and I think it's another part of it is not being willing to let go of what is admittedly some of the greatest popular work anybody's ever made.
And we should say for the record that the Jackson estate is suing the makers of the film or the network, whoever it is, you know, claiming that this is false and whatever the legal term is, defamatory or libelous.
Right. But I just want to give us a little bit of credit here as a country. And I think that some of whenever these questions come up about whenever these Me Too oriented questions come up when it comes to artists and what you do now that you know that there are these awful things about them, do you continue to read the books or watch the movies or listen to the music? I think in Michael Jackson's case, I feel like we had like, I don't know that it's settled, but I do think that we had reached a place where I think a lot of us knew that that what these men say in this movie was entirely possible. And I think that we've carried around this space of plausible deniability and also awareness that it's probably true. And it doesn't mean that you don't listen to the music. I think it means that you bring with you an awareness mm-hmm. of everything you're listening to when you listen to it.
Wesley, we just have a minute left, but I want to ask you one last thing.
Sure.
The mothers of Robeson and Safechuck play a big role in this documentary, and you're right that their role in the film was a relief, but where were the fathers? Practically the only men interviewed for the whole documentary were the two victims. Otherwise, it was mothers, grandmothers, and a sister.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, in the case, the movie doesn't really clarify what happened to why Wade's dad isn't in the movie. I'm sorry, why James Safechuck's dad isn't in the movie. Wade Robson's father, you know, I mean, I don't want to ruin for anybody who hasn't seen it the way the story is laid out, but. It's a good question. I think that in one family, you kind of understand what the dynamic was. And I think in James Safechuck's case, I think that, you know, his mother, Stephanie, does make clear that their marriage wasn't mm-hmm. in the greatest shape.
And the mom's role as a relief, why did you use that word? We have 30 seconds.
Because I think that's been the question that we've been accusing. That's been the question we've been asking all of this time is like, what were the parents' role in this? We wouldn't talk about Michael Jackson. We just wanted to go straight to the parents. And to hear these two women really tell a story of their relationship to Michael Jackson and wrestle with the guilt that they feel about what their sons say happened to them is just really powerful and clarifying, I think, morally, because there are questions you can just never answer about what you would do for your children. I mean, you can say that. And yet, you know, when these women were presented with this opportunity to have Michael Jackson in their lives, they took it.
Wesley Morris, New York Times critic at large and co-host of the Still Processing podcast. His new piece on the documentary Leaving Neverland is called Michael Jackson Casts a Spell. Leaving Neverland Breaks It. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks for having me.